And we're back. Welcome back, everyone, to the Higher Standards Podcast. Guys, it feels to me like it's been 3 weeks since we've recorded. Why does it feel like it's been forever?
Because you just got out of a yoga class.
That's got to be it. yeah, I'm kind of out of breath. I'm all stretched out. My back hurts, but I feel good. So, as always, I'm Mr. Jason Roskam. With me each and every single week is the talent Bob. What's up, Bob?
I don't get the talent title this week, but that's fine.
That is true. You are way outclassed today. But we've also got our social media coordinator, Chad. What's up, Chad?
Hey, what's up, everybody? How's it going out there in listener land?
And this week, we have a very special guest. Guy needs no real introduction. If you pay attention to any kind of magic content at all, you should know this guy's name. Ross Merriam. Ross, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I've never really had an introduction like that, so...
We try to make everybody feel special here on Higher Standards. So
you've succeeded.
Awesome.
So
Ross,
just
before we like jump into a lot of this stuff, why don't you just tell everybody a little bit about who you are and kind of what it is you do?
Sure. So I guess first and foremost, I am a competitive player and have been for several years now, almost full time, and playing SEG Tour Opens and Invitationals and Grand Prix and a few Pro Tours along the way. And then starting almost 2 years ago now, I started writing a column for Star City Games, and that has grown to where I am now a weekly columnist. And starting this year, I was taken on to do Versus Video, so I do video content for StarCityGames.com as well.
Nice. And those are always very popular amongst the readers.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That's particularly when like new rotation comes out. It's nice to see you guys play new cards and see their interactions and your
thoughts.
It's
more fun for us too. We get to just play around with a bunch of cards.
I love watching like you or like Tom Ross has some of the funniest stuff on those videos. I guess I'll just play this. It's like, wow, I'm sure there was a lot of thought in that, but he just makes it seem like, yeah, I'll just play this.
Yeah, Tom is a man of few words, but he makes all of those words count.
Yes. Yes, yeah.
Very much so.
Silent Bob.
None of them are wasted.
No, never. So before we kind of roll into our main topic, I guess we've got to take care of the farewell, right, Jason?
No, I think we've got one other little subject to
we're
touch
really
on.
Gonna do this.
We
gonna,
are.
I'm gonna have a tirade now.
Hey, that's fine. That's fine. Tirade away, and I leave the floor open for everybody to give their opinions. But we had a little banned and restricted list update today. Bob is already. He's got his hands buried in his face. If you're not in the Twitch stream right now, you're really missing it. It's pretty good. So as everybody expected, Eye of Ugin was banned in Modern. Not a big surprise. Some people thought maybe it would have been Temple or both, but I think Eye of Ugin was the fairly obvious choice in this.
Yeah, Eye.
Yeah,
Eye is the broken one.
Yeah, for sure. And
Ross, you don't think that Eye punishes you because it's legendary and you know you draw more than one in your opening hand. It's pretty pretty rough. I mean,
when it makes four mana, having one that's dead in your hand and one in play is just as good as two pebbles. But when
Yeah.
I've been through this before with Gaia's Cradle. You just play four of them.
Yeah.
No, you're right. You're right.
When you were a big elves player.
All right. So, but in addition to I leaving, we also had some, kind of unexpected unbans. Ancestral Vision was taken off of the ban list for Modern, which I think some people did kind of see coming. A lot of people have been calling for that for quite a while, but I'm honestly surprised that they did it.
So, Ross, do blue players get back in the game now in Modern?
Ancestral is a very good card. As far as what is going to do to the format, no one knows. People are certainly going to try. I hope that it does something to help control decks be a thing. That would be nice. It's something we haven't seen in Modern for a while. I was also surprised at the significant unbans they had because I thought they would want to see how the twin ban would shake out in a real metagame as opposed to the broken one that we've had for the last few months. But I think they just went off the numbers and saw how bad blue was even in this broken metagame and sort of assumed that even with Eldrazi leaving, blue decks probably wouldn't have been very good and they needed a bit of a boost. So now they have Ancestral Vision and Sword of the Meek.
Yes, and that was the other one that got unbanned, Sword of the Meek. Obviously, the main reason that was banned was the Thopter Foundry combo. A lot of people are now also talking about that with Monastery Mentor. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this unfolds. Bob, what do you think about Sword?
I've got my Thopter Sounders all ready to go.
Oh, yeah.
And I think, I don't know, I haven't had a lot of time to think about it. I read it at work and I kind of had a bunch of other stuff, but they're both low mana cost spells, and you could probably jam them in a control deck as a win condition, you know, pretty cheaply. I mean, they don't cost a lot to cast, but I mean, I don't know. I never really played with them in Modern a lot, so I'm probably the wrong guy to ask with this one. Ross, what do you think about them?
The last time that people were playing with Thopter Foundry and Sword of the Meek was 5 years ago in the extended format. It was great. And we actually saw Chris Anderson played them in Legacy last year when Time was legal. He used Thought Scour as a way that could enable the combo and enable Delve for Dig Through Time. and it was good there. It is incredibly powerful. The reality is that we now live in a world that has Abrupt Decay and Culligan's Command, and so there are widely played spells that are in people's main decks that can break up the combo that didn't exist before. So I feel like people are going to go back to the drawing board and look at the list from 5 years ago for inspiration, but you're probably going to have to sort of rebuild them from the ground up with these new cards in mind. And if you're really going to dedicate your deck to winning with this combo, you probably have to play a few more of them.
Yeah.
You can't just sort of tutor them out and be confident that they're going to stay in play. But the power of the combo is so high that if they don't have an answer within the first 1 to 2 turns that it's in play, you're making 2, 3, 4 or more Thopters a turn and gaining that much life. You can very easily run away with the game even if they find the combo, even if they only give you 2 turns with it. So Anytime you have any sort of powerful card or combination of cards that can run away with the game that quickly, even if spells that deal with them are ubiquitous, it's going to be powerful because you can finagle the game in a way that you just get that brief window of time to abuse the combo, and that's enough time to run away with the game.
Right.
So I would be surprised if these things didn't see any play, although I think the same could have been also said of Bitter Blossom, where that was in banned and it hasn't seen much play.
Yeah.
But Bitter Blossom does not run away with the game nearly as quickly as Thopter Foundry does, because you're limited in your rate of return, where you're only getting one creature every turn cycle. And the life loss from Bitter Blossom is also very relevant in a format that's higher powered. And so the life gain is going to be similarly relevant on the other side for the Thopter Foundry Sword of the Meat combo. So I expect this to certainly well outperform Bitter Blossom, sure, which might be a comparison that many people will draw.
Yeah.
So I certainly expect it to see a reasonable amount of play. I'm wondering if the Tezzeret, Agent of Bolas decks become a thing. They just incorporate this as another powerful element rather than focusing their entire deck around it, like the old Thopter Depths decks and Extended. I would be interested in playing a shell like that. I think Tezzeret, Agent of Bolas is a pretty sweet card. It's pretty vulnerable to Lightning Bolt, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true.
I guess it starts on 3, and then you +1 to +4, so that's not too bad. If you make a 5-5 and then bolt your Planeswalker, you still have a 5-5. So it's actually not that vulnerable to Lightning Bolt. But So I could see decks like that doing well. And then Ancestral, like, it's sort of anyone's game what kind of reactive spells people want to pair with their Ancestral. It awkwardly doesn't play well with Jace Friend's Prodigy or with Snapcaster Mage.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let me just ask.
Wait, does,
can
you Jace gives the card Flashback?
It lets you cast it from your yard. I got to read
Snapcaster
the card now.
Gives it Flashback.
Yeah, Snapcaster gives it Flashback.
It doesn't play well with Snapcaster.
Okay.
Because I think the Ancestral Vision has reminder text that says cards without mana cost can't be cast or whatever. So that, no, because Cascade lets you do it.
Yeah, I think I it know. Works with Snapcaster. I don't know.
It definitely doesn't work with Snapcaster. People would have done that already.
Yeah,
it's true.
So it doesn't work with either of them. I'm not exactly sure why. We can consult. I'm sure judges will let us know.
Yeah.
I don't think it works with either of them, but I think it fits in those kinds of decks. Like the Grixis control deck that has seen a little bit of play. It's certainly not as good as something like Dig Through Time or Treasure Cruise would be, but I don't think it's that far off from those cards. I think it's enough to make those decks very good. And certainly those Grixis decks tended to get sort of outmaneuvered by Jund, because Jund's cards pound for pound were more powerful.
Right.
They were able to obtain such a raw resource advantage that their individual card quality, they overcome their individual card quality advantage, then you can turn that matchup around. And I think Ancestral Vision is the type of card that does that. And it does it nicely to where you get it out of your hand quickly, and so it's not vulnerable to discard spells.
All right.
So I think it'll help those decks a lot, and I would expect to see a lot of them in Modern in the next few weeks, especially with the Invitational coming up in Columbus.
Oh, that's right. Yep. Okay, so let me ask you guys just one more question before we get away from this topic. Is Eldrazi dead in Modern at this point? Like,
no.
Is it going to be a Tier 1 deck still, or is it being knocked down to, say, a Tier 2 type of deck?
I mean, for my part, I don't know. I don't think it's dead. I mean, drawing two Eldrazi temples and playing a Thought Nazi on turn two is still pretty disgusting. I mean, you know, like,
yeah.
I mean, you still have, that ape that you can exile from your hand to give you a red.
Oh,
I mean,
Simeon Spirit Guide.
Yeah, Simeon Spirit Guide. I mean, you can still play a Reality Smasher on turn two. That's still pretty gross. And you know, what it doesn't allow you to do, now is, you know, hit somebody for 15 on turn two with Eldrazi Mimics. I mean,
yeah. Mimic Reality Smasher. Good game.
Yeah. 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 I mean, Ross, is it still tier one, you think?
Certainly not. I think, what really changes with the rule I is that the incentive to completely load up your deck with Eldrazi creatures the way they've been built, over the last couple months is gone, because you're sacrificing a lot of, card power in the last like 10 slots or so when people were playing Eldrazi Sky Spawner or Vile Aggregate or something like that. Because they're Eldrazi and you can cast them on the cheap with your eyes. But Reality Smasher and Thought Knotseer individually are just very powerful cards in their own right, and certainly at a power level where I could see them being played in Modern. So I think what you will see is a shift away from total Eldrazi decks to decks that want to use the really powerful Eldrazi and use Temple as a way to accelerate them out, but as part of a larger game plan.
Right. Kind of like that old black-white Eldrazi deck that was floating around before the Pro Tour, stuff like that, where it played like Lingering Souls and, you know, Path to Exile.
It was more of a mid-range deck that had some synergies. It played main deck Relic, and like main deck Relic would be very good when people are playing a lot of Thopter Sword. Some more akin to that. And that deck was never great. That was a modern deck.
Yeah.
All right. Chad, anything on the banner restricted list before we move on? You've been kind of quiet over there.
No, let's talk Standard.
All right, so let's get out of that, and we're gonna finish up our farewell to Khanza Tarkir and Fate Reforged, though we're not covering Colorless today. Maybe we'll do that as kind of a side project on the Facebook group.
I think there's only really, I figured we'd throw the fetches in there, obviously.
Yeah, I mean,
talk
those
about those, but like the fetches, I don't know that we really even need to talk about them. Like they, it changes the format so much.
Yeah.
We've talked about that on this show. I don't know how many times.
There are a couple other good colorless cards. Ugin being one of the big ones.
Yep.
But
yep.
Yeah, we can. Maybe we'll do something special on the Facebook group. So if you're not a part of the Facebook group, go ahead and join that, and we'll make some sort of list for that. But this week we're running through green and multicolor or gold. So Ross, I don't know if you made your own list for this.
I do have lists prepared for both.
All right, excellent.
All right, came prepared for class.
So we're going to start with green. We're going to start with green, and then we're going to go through everybody's number five, then everybody's number four, so on and so on. We'll stick Ross a second behind Chad. So, Chad, we'll start with you. What is your number five green card?
My number five is Become Immense. As we all know, we've been talking about this for weeks. Delve was amazing, and this was just one of those finisher cards with Team or Battle Rage. It was even more broken.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, Delve. Delve has been a recurring theme as we've been doing these farewell lists. So with that, Ross, what about you? What's your number five?
My five is Yasova Dragonclaw.
Ooh.
Okay.
It's a card that did not see very much play, but is a card that I really liked when it was spoiled, and I'm sad that it didn't see much play while it was here, so I'm going to honor it while I have the chance.
Yeah, I know. we talked her up a lot on the show when she was spoiled, and we thought she had really high high upside, but yeah, never really materialized.
Just a three drop that doesn't provide immediate value. Like, it needs to stay around to get value from it, but dies to everything. And that is just wasn't a good combination.
Yep.
But it was a reasonable sideboard card when you were green and red and you were playing against a creature deck that didn't have a lot of removal, which is obviously a very narrow range of situations, but those situations did happen. We boarded the card in red-green landfall against green-white Megamorph, and it was quite good there.
Yeah.
Nice. All right.
Exactly what I expected it to do, which was really cool things and something that was fairly unique to have the Act of Treason effect stapled onto a creature.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I remember as we were doing some tournament coverage, we saw her popping up in some of your sideboards there, and we made mention of that because, yeah, beyond that, she never really got much play. So, all right, my number five is Heir of the Wilds. Nice little role player who kind of got outclassed when we started getting cards like Sylvan Advocate, but was in a lot of the early Abzan builds. The Death Touch was no joke. A 2-2 for 2 was not the greatest, but had that Death Touch and then that Ferocious trigger, and it was a very solid card, very good uncommon.
Well, with Anafenza curved in, I mean, it was very easy to pull off that Ferocious trigger. I mean,
yeah.
Basically attacked for 3 on the next turn if you curved out.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. And then, Bob, what about you?
So my number 5 was Hardened Scales, because I thought the card was awesome when it got spoiled. It really didn't find a deck. You know, it had a tier 2 deck that it played with a couple of times. And then, you know, this last GP Houston kind of got its only and last hurrah. But man, that deck, I remember playing against that deck. And, God, I forget who I played against. It was like round 5 at GP Houston. And he dropped like Thopter and he dropped like a Hangerback Walker, and he just played a Mana Gorger Hydra and made it ridiculous on like turn 4. It was sick. He emptied his hand. I was like, go ahead, Ross.
I played the Hardened Scales deck in Houston.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, yeah. I sat across from a guy playing Four Color Rally, and on game 1 it was like, I had a slower start, and he played a Mana Gorger Hydra and made it ridiculous, and it's like, well, that thing has trample. Huh.
Yeah.
This is very bad for me. I need to draw a Reflector Mage right now.
Earlier that week, I had arranged for some of the other SCG guys to come over to my apartment, and we were testing for Houston, and I was ready to start testing with the Mono Blue Eldrazi deck that had done well the previous weekend RPTQs. This is my kind of deck. I was really excited about it. I picked up some of the cards that I needed for it, had it built. Brad Nelson comes over, opens the door, and is like, do you know what you're playing this weekend? And I tell him, no, but I'm leaning towards this Blue Eldrazi deck. We talked about this last night, so I'm a little confused. And he just goes, oh, then you haven't heard yet. And he just busts out the Hardened Scales deck, obliterates me in like 7 straight games. And I was like, okay, I do know what I'm playing this weekend.
Nice. Yeah, that deck was nutty.
Yeah. Right before the last set came out, wasn't it like becoming like a tier 1 deck in Standard? Like it was just
got some play. I remember guys at our local game store played it a little bit. Bernie played it a lot, and I saw it around.
All right, moving on. Number 4, Chad, what you got?
My number 4 is Whisperwood Elemental. Cost 5, 4/4. It manifests at the beginning of the end step, and it saves everybody else on your team.
Yeah. Card was good, man.
Yeah.
It's higher on my list. I'll just say that.
Okay.
All right, Ross, what about you? Number 4.
My number 4 is Rattleclaw Mystic.
Yes.
This was a card that I was pretty excited by when Khonzatar Gear was spoiled, and I had it pretty high on my list of cards in the set, mainly because I really like the idea of curving Elvish Mystic into Morph Rattleclaw into a 6-drop on turn 3.
Ooh.
There were never really any great 6-drops to accelerate into, but Rattleclaw and Elvish Mystic definitely became best friends in Green Devotion, a deck I played a lot of. And I just like me a good mana creature. This one happened to like be cool with like, Deathmist Raptor, and we saw that in Green Red Dragons. That came up. So it is a mana creature that could attack a little bit and gave you a little bit of value with some morph synergies here and there. We had it in our Green Devotion deck with Trail of Mystery in the sideboard. And it was part of this like big trail plan that was really good against control decks. So I like me a mana creature. Rattleclaw was a good one.
Yeah. And it ended up being the best mana dork in Standard for a while after we lost Mystic. So
yeah.
My number 4 is was Chad's number 5, Become Immense. It's a multi-format all-star, but it's also kind of narrow, I think. It's You're really just putting it in these hyper-aggressive decks where you're just kind of trying to finish off your opponent in one swipe. So it's not higher on my list, but yeah, just solid, solid card. And again, Delve is dumb.
So my number... Sorry, Ross.
Become Immense is sort of the card that proves to everyone that Delve is really dumb. If you look at this and you're just like, well, it's just a pump spell, whatever, but it just costs one mana. It's so absurd. And then you realize, okay, if this card is really good, then all the other Delve cards, Murder Scut, Treasure Cruise, Dig Through Time, they have to just be utterly insane.
Yeah.
Because Delve just makes everything good. Just like Phyrexian mana. When people started playing Gutshot, and they're like, oh, let's start trying Mutagenic Growth. And then that one ended up being good because it was good against Gutshot. It just keeps snowballing from there.
Ross, when they spoiled Delve, were you guys like down at SCG like, this is ridiculous? Because I remember when they spoiled it up by us, it wasn't like this massive thing. It was like, well, Treasure Cruise costs 8, so maybe, you know, you got a fetch or two in there, so maybe you pay like 6 to draw 3. It's a sorcery. Jace's Ingenuity gets you 3. It's an instant. I don't know if this is... Or was everybody at SCG like, it's on, guys. Like, the days of Ancestral Recall are back.
It actually took a while for Dig and Treasure Cruise to really catch on. I remember that first weekend, Dig Through Time ended up going from like $4 to 15 over the course of it, and then... Bob Huang, I think, who won the Legacy Open that weekend in New Jersey with Blue Red Delver with Treasure Cruise.
Yeah.
Sort of let everybody know that was there. I just hadn't really thought about Legacy at all. So I didn't catch on to Cruise being absurd because I was just still on the Elf train then.
Yeah.
But for those of us that have been playing since the last time Delve was a thing, the Delve cards weren't insane in Standard because we didn't have strong enablers like we did with Fetchlands.
Yeah.
And the mana bases around that time weren't playing a million Fetchlands like they did after Battle. Mm. So I don't think it was immediately obvious how great the Delve cards were, although it was pretty clear early on that Murderous Cut was going to be a great Standard card.
Sure.
Yeah. So they just ended up pushing a lot of the Delve cards in Concept Arc here, and then that combined with Fetchlands made them absurd. So it just goes to show you how much context matters a lot in card evaluations.
Sure.
But from my end, I think it was very clear early how good Murderous Cut was. It didn't take long to figure out how good Dig was, at least in Standard, and obviously did not take long to figure out Cruise, but it wasn't immediately obvious.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So my number 4 was Whisperwood Elemental, and I think we went over this. He's awesome. He's 6 power, 6 toughness by the end of your turn for 5 mana with upside. So
yeah,
absolutely. All right, Chad, what you got?
I'm a big fan of combo decks, and my number 3 is Teamer Sabertooth. Oh, it was one of those... one of those cards that enabled the combo to be viable, and it by itself it wasn't terribly bad either.
That wasn't that like a Teemer Ascendancy?
Yeah.
Infinite draw kind of decks. So,
yeah,
I remember when that was a thing. That's a long time ago.
Oh yeah.
Yep. Sabertooth was also critical in the green-white devotion deck that everyone hated. So,
yeah, that's right.
They were each at 300 life. How's this one going to end?
you ended up using Sabertooth to just recur your own Polukranosis so you could activate the Polukranos more times than your opponent. that was the end game.
That's so great.
It was good.
what a great Standard meta.
All right, Ross, what's your number 3?
My number 3 was someone's number 5, I think. I don't remember exactly who, but it's Heir of the Wilds.
Ah, yes, that was mine.
Yeah. Good call. But Heir is a card that I always had an affinity for, mainly because it was a card that I had pegged during that spoiler season as an underrated card from the set. I like just finding solid aggressive creatures that can maintain relevancy later in the game, and Death Touch obviously lets Heir do that. And ended up seeing sporadic play here and there, sometimes being outclassed, and eventually definitely being outclassed by Sylvan Advocate. But Heir, it did its job. It was a serviceable man, usually like a 2-of or 3-of in decks just to fill out the curve. And so I was happy that to see it sort of live up to what medium hype I gave it.
Yep. Nice. Cool. All right. My number 3 is Whisperwood Elemental. We've talked about him a lot. A very solid card. Got a lot of play. I did play a little bit of Green Devotion with him. Also played some of the Megamorph decks with him. So he's a very, very solid creature. And just... It, uncontested for a couple of turns, it's game over at that point. If they can't remove him right away, oof, bad news.
Yeah, So my number three was Rattleclaw Mystic, for all of the reasons that Ross gave and all of the reasons that, oh no, he's number two. We haven't even gotten to Jason's yet. So yeah, I mean, just a good mana dork. The flip up interaction with his morph is obviously very interesting. And once, you know, there wasn't anything good with six to ramp into until Chandra. And then that got really nutty.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yep. Rattleclaw Mystic, solid card.
Cool. All right. And we're up to number two. Chad, what you got?
My number two is Warden of the First Tree. It was the one drop aggressive creature everybody was looking for, and it could sustain over the course of the game. You had to play in different colors, but I mean, who wasn't when we had all those fetch lands lying around?
Yeah, he was the token one drop in Abzan. So.
Oh, you mean I have to play black and white with my green cards?
Oh, so sad.
I have no idea which shell this goes in.
Feels bad, man.
Yep. All right. What about you, Ross? Number two.
My number two is Whisperwood Elemental.
Okay.
Like I said, the card is great. It was also super sweet with Trail of Mystery. You just make it and get a land every turn.
Yeah.
It was.
Now that is one combo I have never played. That's quite interesting. My number two was Rattleclaw Mystic. We've been talking about it this whole time. It was higher on my list just because I gotta say, this was one of the best mana dorks, we could have had in standard. He had, longer term upside. If you drew him third, fourth turn, he was still pretty decent because he can still ramp you quite a bit the next turn after you cast him, down as a morph. Just, very solid card. I played him a lot in the Eldrazi ramp deck last format. So he was great.
My number two was Warden of the First Tree. Talked about him a lot. There were some curve outs with Abzan where if you played this guy on turn one, some decks with the wrong draw just couldn't beat you. And, if you curved out. So, solid one drop.
All right. Chad, number one.
My number one was Rattleclaw Mystic, basically for the same reason, everybody has noted, especially Jason. He was the go-to mana dork that everybody was looking for because we had no one drops.
Yep. And we may never again in standard, which is
kind of
sad.
Oh, God, no.
Please don't say
we're never getting Elvish Mystic again unless they completely reshape how standard operates. This is way too good. It's just Mox Emerald.
Yeah, it's exactly like it. It's basically a reprint of it. All right. So, Ross, what do you have for your number one card? Green card for Cons and Fate.
My number one was Warden of the First Tree. As someone who likes being aggressive, obviously one drop is going to be pretty high on my list. I think it's important to remember that this card did not see a lot of play during its first rotation through standard because the temple mana bases prevented you from really curving out that efficiently in the early game, which is what Warden really wants.
Yeah.
But the fetch battleland mana bases let you do that, and Warden was able to shine more effectively after that. I think like Andy Boswell had an Abzan aggro deck that played four mana confluence, and he used Warden in that pretty effectively, but he's a crazy person. So Warden got his chance to shine once Battle for Zendikar came in, and I'm pretty thankful for that. I really like one mana creatures that, again, stay relevant later in the game. This one can even just take over a game. So having your card that you want to see in your opening hand also be the card that you want to draw on turn 10 is not something that happens often and something that's really valuable to me. Also, interesting story about Warden of the First Tree. At Grand Prix Houston, playing the Hardened Scales deck, I had my opponent make his I think it was a 25-25. Oh, he's had two counters from Dravoka's Command.
Yeah.
That still wasn't good enough.
Because
I had like three Hangerback Walkers that were all bigger than 10-10. And I had two Hardened Scales in play, so every turn I'm adding 9 power, 3 to each Hangerback Walker every turn. Nice. And he's only adding 5 power by activating the Warden. So he was actually losing if he had just waited, and he ended up having to like trade a bunch, and then I just beat him down with Thopters.
Got him.
Death by Thopter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Alright.
Four activations of that card wouldn't be good enough, but Hardened Scales are super powerful.
Yep, and I'm with Ross. My number one was also Warden of the First Tree.
High five.
Yeah, for everything we just talked about. So, Bob, you are the last one. What you got?
I am the last one. So my number one has become immense. Like Ross, I enjoy playing aggressive decks more in Eternal formats than I do in standard, really. But I just look when the Teamer Battle Rage combo came out. I mean, this card was played before them. When Teamer Battle Rage came out, the thing was the boogeyman for I can't remember how long. And you know, I play Infect in Legacy, and this card is just. It's like being able to play more Berserks in your deck. It's just silly.
Yeah.
I mean, you know. So.
All right. And before we get on with gold, I just want to tell everybody, we right before we started recording, I had kind of a thought, and we changed it up a little bit. The three of us, me, Chad, and Bob, took Siege Rhino out of our list because I just assumed it was going to be everybody's number one gold card, so we took it out of our list. So that's why if you don't hear us say Siege Rhino, it's because... we just assumed everybody was going to talk about it anyway.
Screw that card. It's horrible.
It's Siege Rhino.
Yeah. And I'm sure Russ has it somewhere in his top five. I'm just gonna throw that out there.
My gold card list is it is unique.
Ooh, I like
all
that.
All right, awesome.
And actually, I think mine is too, so we shall see. Hopefully it's we get a little more variance in this one than we did in the green. So
a gold set.
That is true. So, all right. Chad, we'll start with you. Number five, gold card in Cause
of Fate. As Bob was saying, so many golds, so much gold to go through. So my number one, or number five, was Jeskai Ascendancy. Again, I'm a big fan of the combo decks, and Ascendancy was one of the big combo decks that people had to play around, had to play their meta around, and it even lasted like later on in the game.
Yeah, I mean, it was really one of the early boogeymen, and... Yeah, it kept rearing its head every once in a while.
Okay.
All right. Ross, what do you got for number five?
Number five. Okay. I'm going to go with Ice Feather Aemon.
My favorite card art in a long time, Ross. Regardless of what the card does, I think the art on that is just fantastic.
The art is great. And this is a card that I would have loved to have played in Standard, but which just wasn't powerful enough to break through. It was still super sweet and limited, and I really enjoy, I like cool little tempo creatures. If I'd been able to play it in Standard, I certainly would have, but I definitely played a lot of it in Limited when I could, so Ice Feather Aemon.
Nice. Yeah, I played more Cons Limited than I did of any other set in history, in my history of Magic, and he was a big one for me also. I loved the Morph decks. I tried to draft all the five-color morph decks I could, and it was a lot of fun, and this guy was just fantastic.
I also liked drafting blue-green aggressive decks with Savage Punch and the Alpine Grizzly.
Oh,
my second favorite card art of the set, Savage Punch.
All right, my number five is also a little personal favorite. It is Salumgar, the Drifting Death. If anybody who listened to this show a year ago or whenever the hell it was that Fate Reforged came out, I was huge on Salumgar, and I played him in blue-black control for a couple of months. He was a pet card of mine. I absolutely loved him. He was kind of my finisher in those decks, and I just really kind of prayed I didn't play against Crackling Doom, but he was great, and he really hosed a lot of decks at the time. So,
yeah. I lost to that card a lot.
Oh, did you? Yeah. But yeah, Drifting
but
Death.
It's so big.
Yeah. And that hexproof, man. And yeah, like I said, I was playing a lot of blue-black control at the time, and he was the top of my curve. It was fantastic. So Bob, what's up?
So my number five was hard because Salumgar is also kind of a pet card. Jason, you and I played a lot of blue-black control during that time period.
Yes,
and I loved that card. But Sorum Psalm Visitor is my number five. I thought the card was just flavor-wise. I thought it was really cool when it got spoiled. It did everything you'd expect a vampire to do: made other vampires, drained life. But I really like Soren because I felt like he just gave you some reach in like Abzan decks. You know, Siege Rhino wasn't enough to get you, you know, some extra life. This guy certainly coming down on like turn four after an Anofenza could do it for you. And I just felt he's a cool card. Also, Black-White Tokens in Modern has been a pet deck of mine for a while. I don't play it a lot other than casually, and he's really fun in that deck. So
yeah, and he was very undervalued, and like people did not see a whole lot out of him when he was first spoiled.
I always felt it was a shame that the Planeswalker deck never came together, because if you played him on turn four after an Oath of Jace, you basically had one turn until you emblemed him, and then people were sacking creatures every turn. And I thought... you know, I've seen that deck played, and I messed around with it, and I always thought it was a cool interaction.
Yep.
So,
for sure. All right, Chad, number four.
My number four, as Bob's number five, is Soren Solemn Visitor, again for the same reason. Abzan, this was one of those, Abzan Aggro, Abzan Midrange, this was one of those curves that just topped it off. And this,
yeah, back in the days when those were different decks.
Yeah, exactly. When, no offense, Ross, but when Star City didn't know what to name Abzan, this is the one, this is the card that stayed true to both.
Yeah. All right, Ross, what about your number four?
My number four is another Abzan card, although one that didn't see a lot of play, and it's Abzan Ascendancy.
Mm.
This is a card that I actually bought four of right before in the Pro Tour Battle for Zendikar when we were testing, because we were all, everybody was sort of building different Nantuko Husk sacrifice decks because there were so many different tools for it, but it was really difficult to figure out what the best list would be, and our list used Abzan Ascendancy to very good effect, and I thought Ascendancy would be a key card in them. Ended up being Rally that was the overpowered card, and that's the one that everybody saw, so Ascendancy sort of got put by the wayside, but I liked a lot of the things that Abzan Ascendancy did, and it made the... It was a really intricate card in those decks because you could play it sometimes even with only one creature in play because the spirit mode is really the most powerful part of it. And just getting it down so that you could start playing your creatures and be guaranteed that you get spirits out of them was important. But there were some times that you needed to wait and really get the anthem effect if your opponent was a little removal light and you needed to be ahead on board. So it was a more flexible card than people give it credit for. And so I really enjoyed playing with it during those couple weeks, and I'm sad that Rally sort of invalidated it.
Yeah, because, I mean, on paper, it looks like a very good card. But, you, again, you got to think about the context, the format it was in. And I think we may have just lost Ross from the call. We'll try to add him back. Oh, call dropped.
No, it's call dropped. Yeah, you need to add him back in.
All right.
Can we do that, or do we have to hang up and recall him?
I've got the add to group call option. So
okay,
we'll,
cool.
We'll see if it...
Hello?
Hey,
yeah,
there he is.
Back here.
Sorry. Not a problem. That was a slight hiccup. No worries. We'll cut that out in post. So
awesome.
My number four is Sidisi Brood Tyrant. A lot of people forgot about this card, but in the early days of cons, things like Sultai Reanimator were good decks. And
Nyx Weaver.
Yeah, you know, back when we had the old Whip of Erebos, and it's people forget about those days because it's been so long now, but Sidisi was a big card in a lot of those lists, and Sidisi was very solid. So Sidisi is definitely my number four.
My number four is Culligan the Storm's Fury. There was a point in the standard where I just didn't know what I wanted to play, and then our good buddy Dan Ward and a couple other guys started playing that Black Red Dragons deck, and I just latched onto that thing and rode it to victory time after time after time at IQs, and it was by far, when Thoughtseize was still legal and Bioblight was still legal and Hero's Downfall was still legal, I loved that deck, and this thing made it just nutty.
Yeah.
So Culligan the Storm's Fury, my number four.
Very nice. Very solid card. Alright, and we are now up to three. Chad, what do you got?
My number three is Savage Knuckleblade.
Aww.
What? Come on.
Teamer, come on.
Yeah, I feel like this was such an underrated card. That, I mean, and when it got played, it was one of those cards that you had to deal with or else. And it hits close to home. That's all. That's all.
but it was okay. Teamer, man. Come on. Teamer was never good. I don't care what anybody says. Teamer was never good.
All right.
I've got all the team.
That was not the blade. Was just a trap.
Yeah. Thank you, Ross. see, I feel vindicated now.
Ross, is your number three a trap?
Which one of my remaining three is a trap?
Okay.
All right.
My number three is a solid card, though.
All right. Okay. What you got?
It is Jeskai Charm.
Oh yeah.
This is a card sort of waxed and waned over its lifetime in standard, but I was always a much bigger fan of the Jeskai decks that used it than didn't, because it was such a flexible card. Of all the charms, probably other than Abzan, Jeskai was the one that had the most variability in which modes you chose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because all three were relevant, and like, that's the interesting part about charms, is having three different effects. So the ones that are just only one or two of them are good, but they're good enough to make the card worth playing, are a lot less interesting than the ones that actually have three really good options. Mm-hmm. And Jeskai Charm definitely fit that bill. And
yeah, those the aggressive Jeskai decks, I don't know how many times I had an opponent go, attack with Manus Rider, Lightning Strike you, at the end of your turn, untap Jeskai Charm, you're dead. Just, it's such a solid card. 4 damage to the face is pretty disgusting.
That, I put you on tilt with Jeskai Ascendancy with that card.
Did you?
That and Hordling Outburst.
Oh, God.
I came back from one life to kill you. It was great.
Oh, that's right. I remember that. And then I raved about it there the next night on the podcast.
You crapped all over me on the podcast before I was a co-host. It was horrible. A lot of therapy has been used to get over that. So what's your number 3, Jason?
All right. Soren Solemn Visitor. We've already mentioned him. Very solid card. Role player in a lot of decks. There were some decks that were built completely around him, and then some decks where he only ended up being like a 1 or 2 of. But solid player, like Bob said, a little bit modern applicability. So that's
it. My number 3 was Mantis Rider. Talk about a card that just does everything I want a 3-drop to do. It comes down, it flies, it has vigilance, and it hits you right in the face for 3 the minute it enters the board if you don't take care of it. And if one's good, and the other thing I like about my 3-drops, if one of them's good, the second one is just so much better. It kind of whacked, kind of also, had its time in the sun and then didn't for a while, came back towards the end of Standard. And then when Rally became a thing, this thing became just such a, being a dedicated Rally player, this thing was just such a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
I mean, if you didn't have an answer to this thing like a Reflector Mage, it was like, although, Ross, I played, at SCG Atlanta, I played, I think, Andrew Tenjam, like, day 2, I forget what, it was one of my later games. And I kept Reflector Maging his Mantis Rider, and Ketter were playing that Jeskai Black to your face deck.
Yeah.
You know, and I kept Reflector Maging, Jeskai Burn. And I kept Reflector Maging his Mantis Rider, and he like wouldn't one game, and he just didn't do anything. And I'm like, what the hell is going on here? He's got almost a full grip. I'm building my board. He's not flipping anything. And at the end of the game, he just was so sullen, he just drops his hand, and there's 4 of them in his hand. He's like, I figured it was an auto keep, because if you didn't have Reflector Mage, you were just dead. I'm like, yeah, that's really rough, man. Ugh.
All right, moving on to number 2. Chad, what is yours?
Oh, my number 2 is also Mantis Rider. It's the same thing as Bob said. This card is amazing when it hit the field, and it, like early or late game, this thing was very good.
It worked.
All right. Ross, what about you? Number 2.
My number 2 is Sidisi Brood Tyrant.
Ah.
Of the clan leaders, the con leaders?
Yeah.
That cycle. Of the 4, this was the one that I sort of just liked the most. Not necessarily based on power level, although I think there are formats where this would have been the most powerful of them.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that it enables a lot of cool synergies, and leaves behind some immediate value on most of the time is really appealing. And I actually played Sultai Whip for a couple weeks in that format, and it was a super fun deck, and Sidisi was a big part of it. So
sweet. All right, and what are we on, number 2, right? Okay, my number 2 is also Mantis Rider. I loved playing it, especially in the once Jeskai Black became a thing. I was playing the more Mantis Rider, aggressive, less control-y build of Jeskai Black, and it was fantastic. Good card. I've beaten many people with it, and I've been beaten by it many a times. So that's my number 2.
So my number 2 was Crackling Doom. I was a big 4-color control player, Mardu Blue, whatever the hell you want to call that deck. And Crackling Doom was a great card. Was great in Mardu when it first came out. Kind of went away for a little bit. And then when people started playing big chunky creatures, when Esper Dragons became a thing again, this card came roaring back to smack it right in the face and put it in its place. So just a great removal spell.
Pretty good against Eldrazi, too, from what I hear.
Yeah, not bad.
All right, so we are up to number 1. Chad, what you got?
Number 1, it seems like Bob's just flowing into all my cards. My number 1 is Crackling Doom, because as Bob said, this card was amazing. Yeah. It can finish games, it can take care of their best creature, it can open the door for your creatures to go in. It was just one of those cards where you were just happy playing it every time.
Yeah, and then by the end when they could go flashback it with Jace, yeah, it's just got that much stupider. So.
Yep.
And
the only real weakness of Kraken and Doom is that it's Mardu, and Mardu is horrible. Once the Battleland fetch land mana base is allowed you to play four colors, and you just slot your Mardu card into a real deck, then.
I do have to disagree with Ross on this one, because I did dabble in Mardu quite a bit in the early days of cons, and then a little bit later in the middle as well. So I did have a heart for Mardu.
Friends don't let friends play Mardu.
And then Butcher of the Horde almost made my list, but he didn't. So, all right. Ross, what is your number one gold card?
I bet you it's a Mardu card.
My number one gold card is Flying Crane Technique.
What?
Not for any magic-related reasons, but because the Karate Kid is gas.
Yeah, no. I gotta agree with you, Ross. Like, just Deflecting Palm? What a cool card. Like, just the flavor there is awesome.
I definitely made a weird Flying Crane Technique motion whenever I cast the card limited, so.
Do you, get up from the table and pick up one leg? And
chair.
Yeah.
Tell me that's on video somewhere. At either
probably not.
Ah.
Good reason.
Okay.
Was there a lot of alcohol involved in that playtesting session?
No, this is playing in an actual tournament. I had it in my Team Seal deck on day one of GP Nashville.
Oh, nice. Oh, cool. All right. So my number one is a card that I feel was such a good card. This probably would have been my number one even if I had included Siege Rhino, and that's Abzan Charm. Abzan Charm was just such a versatile card. Again, all three modes, very solid. I can't really say enough about this. The draw two, lose two at instant speed. The two plus one counters is really good. The exiling a creature is probably its most used mode. Again, just solid card. I can't say enough about this card.
Yep. My number one was also Abzan Charm for all of the reasons Jason said. I don't think it bears any more discussion. It was just a great versatile spell.
Cool. Yep.
And obviously everyone's, well, probably not Ross's because he's probably a better player than all of us. He is a better player than all of us. Was probably Siege Rhino because that card's just ridiculous. Obviously, in my opinion, R&D was doing just a ton of drugs when they did that card. And, Yeah, that card's 3-4 for, or 4-5 for 4. Sounds good. Hey, why don't we give it Lightning Helix? Yeah, that'll make it interesting. And you know what? Let's just put Trample on there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, hey, it made, it's the reason why Abzan was the most played deck for, 2 years almost? Insane.
Abzan had Thoughtseize and Heroes Downfall and Courser at one point, which were also great, and then Anifenta and the best charm. It was a bit more than Rhino. Rhino took got a lot of the credit and took a lot of the flack. He was sort of the coach.
Yeah.
Or the star player, I guess. He was the LeBron.
Yeah. All right, fair enough.
A lot of other people in the background. A lot of Pippins on the edge.
Yeah. Fair enough.
All right.
So that kind of wraps up, I guess, our farewell, huh, Jason? Huh, Chad?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I gotta say, I absolutely loved Cons and Fate. I think it did wear out its welcome by the end, especially with cards like Rally of the Ancestors. But yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed those more in the earlier days than in the later. The first 6 months after Cons came out, it just great time for Standard. So many diverse decks. Every one of the clans except for Teemer was very good and playable. And then you still had your devotion decks from the Theros block. So that honestly, that's one of the best times in Standard I've ever had, I gotta say.
And we've got a question on the Twitch chat. What about the colorless? And we said earlier that the fetches were one of the things, the driving forces to make all the gold cards viable and basically the entire format. Ugin was amazing, and Ghostfire Blade as well.
But we will do something on the Facebook group to recognize the colorless cards of the block. We'll figure it out in the next couple of days.
Yep.
But moving on.
So, Ross, kind of one of the reasons we wanted to bring you on here, besides hearing about your Flying Crane Technique story, which I probably will never forget.
That was worth the price of admission right there.
Absolutely. That's we could awesome. End the show now. But we won't.
See you guys later.
Okay. Is, you know, you wrote a very interesting article that was kind of in a response to a situation that happened at GP Houston, although maybe not in a response, but I'll let you talk about that, I guess, and I don't want to put words in your mouth. But if anybody, by the way, any of you listeners out there who haven't read the article, it's on Star City Games. It was written on March 17th by Ross, and it's called You Play to Win the Game. And if you're listening to this podcast, you should pause it. And if you haven't read the article, you should pause it and go read the article, because it kind of gives a lot of background. But it basically talks about concessions in professional Magic and Top 8 and the way kind of the tournament scene works. But I guess, Ross, to start off with, do you want to explain to our listeners kind of how the tournament point system works, you know, the cut to Top 8 for those of them that maybe just go to GPs that are only in their backyard or Star Cities that only come to their town, you know, and aren't as proficient in this stuff as you guys and your team is?
Sure. So essentially what happens is you have it's called the Swiss tournament structure. I assume because someone in Switzerland or a Swiss tournament was the first one where they ran it. But, what happens is, you play a set number of rounds. In some tournaments it's based on attendance. In some it's just set. So Grand Prix, you play 15, and Pro Tours, you play 16, stuff like that. But you play someone with the same record as you as well as the tournament can pair it. So obviously if there are an odd number of people in your bracket, one will get paired down or paired up, randomly. But you always play someone in your bracket. And then at the end of the Swiss rounds, they cut to a top eight. But what happens is every win gets you 3 points, every loss is 0 points, and every draw gets you 1 point. And you draw a match usually by running out of time. Yep. So towards the end of the tournament, because tournaments are so big, you end up with a bracket that's larger than eight, usually around the two losses mark. And so it'll typically come down to tiebreakers, and the tiebreaker system has the first tiebreaker is your opponent match win percentage. And because of the way Swiss pairings work, you really want to win early and take your losses as late as possible so that you keep getting paired against people with better records to improve your breakers that way. And then the second tiebreaker, which rarely comes up, is your own game win percentage. But for the most part, it's really just that first tiebreaker that matters. And what happens is at the end of tournaments, you will often see players intentionally drawing, or what I wrote about more specifically is conceding to a player that it needs the extra points to top eight when you already have enough. And those concessions on the surface are not tied to anything outside the game, and there are rules in place where you can't offer someone anything outside the game for a specific match result. But in reality, what's going on is the players who are in the know dance around the system by using very specific phrases and a specific sort of formula to the interaction. And and this is a formula that has sort of been okayed by judges that technically doesn't violate the rules, but they're just doing it so that they can get it over with, get the draw to happen or the concession to happen. And then later some sort of compensation is going to exchange hands.
Right. So what you're saying, Ross, is when it comes to two players and one of them's already a lock for top eight, you would call it a lock for top eight. You know, they already have enough points and the other person isn't. Some interaction between the two of them goes on where, one player offers in some way, shape or form a concession to another, not tied to anything money related or at least ostensibly, money related or anything else, simply because he's a good guy and he doesn't want to dream crush somebody. And so, you know, that's on the surface.
Yeah.
Okay. So then that being said, I think before we dive into kind of all the issues that there are with this, you in your article admit that you have done this before, correct?
I have.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's important to realize that situation isn't the only time these sorts of concessions happen, and it's probably
right.
Not even the most common time.
Right.
Because of the way the competitive Magic system works, everyone is competing not just for cash prizes and invitations to tournaments, they're also competing for pro points if you're playing Grand Prix and Pro Tours, or for SCG points if you're competing on the SCG Tour, and your finish determines the number of points you get rather than your place. It's all based on record unless you make the top eight.
Right.
And so, especially late in the season, when people have very concrete ideas of how many points they need to reach certain levels, because 18 points is what you need to be silver on the Pro Tour. 33 points gets you gold, which qualifies you for every Pro Tour. And then it's like thing, or maybe 50 gets you platinum, which qualifies you with flights and everything and hotels and appearance fees and stuff. And so at the, especially the last Pro Tour, in the last round of Swiss, for, the prize money will only be a different.
Oh.
We lost him again.
Oh, no. Man down. Medic!
Yeah, sorry, Ross.
Did it cut me off?
It cuts you off when you were talking about late in the season when everybody has a concrete idea of on the tour kind of where they are, and we went through the point system and you got the platinum, and so 50 points get you platinum, appearance fees, and all that stuff, and then you cut off right about there.
Yeah, so what happens is some two people might get paired and say their record is 10-5 in the last round of the last Pro Tour. Now, the person who wins that match and finishes 11-5 is going to get 10 pro points, and depending upon exactly where they finish, probably $1,500. And the person that loses is going to get 6 pro points, and based on where they finish, probably $1,000. So the difference in money is only about $500, but the difference between 10 and 6 pro points for one of those people might be huge, because the difference between silver and gold is 3 Pro Tour qualifications and flights to those 3 Pro Tours.
Yeah.
And then the difference between gold and platinum is $12,000 in appearance fees and free hotel rooms for 4 Pro Tours. So those prizes end up dwarfing anything that is on the surface of at the event. And so it ends up being in the best interest monetarily at the time of the two people to have the one person concede to the person who's playing for a higher pro status, and then they just arrange some sort of compensation afterwards. And it's understood that that happens. You don't even talk about it at the time because it's illegal to do so. But whenever whenever two people who are in the know are talking about it, anyone else who knows what's going on understands that they will get compensated afterward, and that they don't think twice about it. Right. And then you probably end up, I would say on average, that person probably just gets like $1,000 or $1,500 for that concession. They probably get all the prizes that the other person would normally get for finishing 11-5.
Gotcha.
And they're happy.
Assuming. I mean, so, you know, is there, Ross, you know, for somebody who maybe it's their first Pro Tour, they've done really well, you know, and they find themselves in a position, or maybe it's a GP, you know, where they're doing really well at, and you find yourself in a position where somebody with a big name, you know, a guy like, and I'm using these names as an example. I have no idea whether anybody has done this or not. So, but you know, a Luis Scott Vargas or a Eric Froelich or Ben Stark or any of those guys, you know, you sit down across the table from them and they say to you, hey, do you care about, you know, your points, you know, and, you know, and then they go into, do you want to concede to me? I mean, it can be, having been on the receiving end of a situation like this as a guy who travels and plays competitively, but certainly is not at the level of you, it can be really daunting because these are guys that have a lot of friends, you know, and maybe this is just my view, Ross. Sometimes it seems like it can be, not all the time, a good old boys club or a girls club if there's, you know, and, you know, if you say no to one of these guys, what happens when you sit across from another one of their buddies, you know, and the situation's reversed, you know, or something like that. You engender bad will.
Exactly. And that was sort of the thrust of Ifor's article on the topic, is that everyone sort of does it and is incentivized to do it because then they get the same favors in return.
Yeah.
And I believe that that's very much true, but I think that is actually a problem with the entire system because it creates the, if not the appearance of, then the reality, then possibly, if not the reality of, then at least the appearance of the good old boys club, where there is a class of people who know what's going on and are able to skirt around the rules, and there's a class of people that aren't, and the people that are in the know are advantaged.
Mm-hmm. And so then why did you choose to write about this? Why bring this up? If everybody knows about it, and let's just say you're in that top tier of player, certainly you're a good player, Ross, and people know you, and I'm sure you've encountered this before. It's favorable to you. You know, why decide to write about this and kind of, and maybe not blow the lid off of it, but put it out there for everyone to see?
So at various times, I've been in these situations where I can either get the concession or give the concession and, on either side of it. And I always emerge from the situation, regardless of my decision at the time, and I've gone both ways, historically. Sometimes I've done it, sometimes I just really felt too uncomfortable to do it, and I didn't. But I always leave feeling somewhat awkward, because I know what was going on was a decision as to whether or not I wanted to sort of violate it, not the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law, the way that it is written and the way that it's enforced in competitive Magic. And because of that, I've had various conversations with other members of the competitive Magic community about this issue going back at least the last year, if not before. And in those conversations, which have generally been very enlightening, I've listened to a lot of arguments for and against the system. And I have found that most players are in favor of it, and it's pretty obvious why it very much favors them for the system to exist, at least in the short term. And I slowly came to the realization that people who are outside of this community that I've been a part of for many years now don't really understand that that's going on. Mm-hmm. And it was weird to me that there's this sort of underground system that's going on that most people aren't aware of, and it was one that I personally wasn't very comfortable with. And I ended up having another in this continuing line of conversations shortly before writing the article about it, and that sort of that and the Eric Ehrlich article sort of served as the spark. So I wasn't really responding directly to Ehrlich's article, but sure, sort of the straw that broke the camel's back, where I just thought about it at varying points so many times, and I decided this is something that I should write about, because it's been sort of one of my goals, at least since I started writing, to try to grow the game as much as I possibly can. And it's not a completely altruistic thing that I'm doing, because personally I think that by growing the popularity of the game, that's the best way for me to succeed personally. So I'm certainly going to come out ahead in this endeavor, because I don't want people to think that I'm painting myself as a paragon of virtue here. I am selfishly looking out for my own interests, but I ultimately think that a lot of the other players in the Magic community who are looking short-term in this, trying to maximize their value at every tournament, are being a bit short-sighted. And what they're doing is inhibiting the long-term growth of the game and its potential as a competitive endeavor, a competitive sport even, for their own personal gain in the short term, and they're costing themselves in the long term. And that may be fine because a lot of these people don't have any aspirations of staying in competitive Magic for a very long time. Normally, you play 5 to 10 years, and that's a pretty long career. And then if you move on to other things, maybe you sporadically come back, especially if you were fortunate enough and good enough to make the Hall of Fame. But it's not like this is a sort of normal career where you're in it for 20, 30, 40 years, and you can build really long-term growth. But so it's hard for me to fault them for trying to maximize their EV in the short term. Mm-hmm. But I, especially recently with the rise of other esports like League of Legends and Hearthstone, I see so much untapped potential for Magic. And I would really like, in my time in the competitive Magic community, however long I am fortunate enough to be able to play the game for a living and sort of market the game for a living, to see if Magic can realize some of that potential that I think it has. And I think this system is one of the ways in which Magic players inhibit the realization of that potential. And there are plenty of others. I don't even think this one is the biggest. I think issues around the role of women in Magic and online bullying and harassment. And these are things that have been talked about a lot as well. I think those are incredibly important. But I think this is one that was particularly non-visible. It's one that a lot of people don't even know happens. Yeah. And so I thought it was important to shed some light on it and get at least some sort of conversation rolling around it. And I've gotten a lot of positive feedback, both from players at all levels and from especially from judges. I was really happy with the response I got from several judges talking about how they wanted to sort of see that system change.
I would imagine this puts them in a real awkward spot too, because, you know, the judges that are at high levels and know what's going on, if it's your job to enforce the rules, you know, this is, as you said, maybe not doesn't break the letter of the law, but certainly maybe the spirit of the law.
Yeah, and it's sort of particularly codified. If it's not hard written into the rules, it's certainly something that judges have helped to devise, the system of what to say. You essentially have to, in the way you approach it and when you're talking to your opponent, explicitly separate the result of the match from any sort of prize split. And usually you ask, okay, you specifically know that it's independent of the result of the match. Would you like to split prizes? And then they say yes. And then you ask, okay, would you like to concede to me or would you like to draw or whatever? And then they say yes. And then you just deal with it after the fact. And it's almost impossible to regulate. And which is why I think we need some sort of community-driven response to it in order to reverse the tide, so to speak. And I think the reason that that judges allow it is because it's difficult to regulate, so it puts them in a very difficult spot where they would have to try to make a very tough judgment call as to whether or not they thought the person was legitimately acting in this way or wasn't. And they were just legitimately trying to get the concession with no expectation of getting compensated afterward. And so it's almost impossible for judges to regulate this themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you, and you reference in your article examples like the Black Sox back in 1919 World Series, if anybody's a baseball fan, or Pete Rose, you know, betting on his own team as a player and a manager. So you believe that this is one of the impediments to making the game more professional because, people on the back end are basically colluding to draw and rather than playing it out, I guess.
Yeah. So the sports analogies fall a little bit flat because the
interest sure.
of gambling and the amount of money that's in that industry
sure.
has caused a lot of that backlash. But I don't think that explains 100% of it, because the reason that sports are popular and other competitive endeavors are popular from an entertainment perspective and popular as sources of entertainment is because they are very close to being meritocracies, and the people succeed or fail on their own merit. And we like to see the sort of pinnacle of human achievement in whatever areas. Professional athletes are often the pinnacle of human physical achievement. And mental athletes can be thought of as the pinnacle of human mental achievement in the same way. And watching people accomplish these great things to the point where they become almost superhuman, it has a high degree of entertainment value, and it makes it very popular for other people to watch.
Yes.
And Magic, for much of its history, was much too small of a community, much too small of a game to generate a lot of revenue based on its popularity as a source of entertainment for other people. And so the revenue stream always came from using the professional tour to market cards to other people that played the game at lower levels. And it came from tournament entry fees, and then they gave back whatever percentage they could, and so the profit margins are really small. But in the last 6 years, Magic's gotten so big that we're starting to see the potential for sponsorships and outside money that gets put into the game to make it grow to levels that we haven't, that personally I could have never dreamed of.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of growth is when we start seeing an actual, realistic class of professional Magic the Gathering players. Right now, it's a very tiny class of them that really make a good living playing tournaments because the money just isn't there. And that's one of the reasons that the community was able to develop this sort of system that favors the players, because the players were basically the only thing that mattered. They were there weren't any outside influences, regulating what actions they could or couldn't take, other than judges, and if it was impossible for judges to regulate, then it went unregulated. But now we're entering a point where we could potentially get those outside influences in the form of sponsorships and get this ad revenue in and start monetizing streams in a way that we couldn't before. And personally, I just don't think we're going to be able to do that effectively if we continue to act solely in the player's best interest, and the player's best interest in the short term. We have to start acting in the interest of viewers, because those are the people that can generate that added outside revenue, and that's the revenue that we need to continue growing the game.
Yeah, because you
sorry, one last thing.
Okay,
you sort of reached the limit of how far the game is going to grow as a competition under this business model, where tournament organizers take in their revenue from the players and then give out some fraction of it, and then use the rest to cover costs and profit. Because we're reaching a point where you can't really increase attendance by much by just adding more money to the prize pool. And so you have to start looking at other things to keep growing. Otherwise, the growth is just going to taper off and eventually fall off. And I think ad revenue and monetizing streams is the way that we're going to have to go about that. And that means prioritizing viewers over players in a lot of aspects. And that's why you see some of the backlash from players, because they think they're going to lose some of the power, or they're going to lose some of their place in the community, their autonomy maybe. But in reality, once you start catering towards viewers, the players become more powerful. Because they're the ones that are driving the viewership. And so now they're directly responsible for a much larger source of revenue than just their $70 tournament entry fee. If they're responsible for 100, 500, 1,000, tens of thousands of viewers, then they're a big deal. And we have some personalities that can drive that kind of viewership. And those people and the community at large is going to have a much more powerful position to take when trying to get their fair share of the revenues, the way athletes have to lobby with owners to get their share of revenues in professional sports.
And I mean, from an aspiring player, if one is trying to hit the level that you and the rest of the quote unquote, I guess we'll call them pro players are, it's got to be well. And I don't know if I could ever hit that level, but from somebody who plays competitively a lot, I can say that it is a little disconcerting to know that stuff like this goes on, because it almost makes you feel like the deck, sorry for the bad pun here, is stacked against you from the get-go, you know?
I agree that that's bad, although the appearance is what matters, and I agree that appearance exists. Although it doesn't actually play out that way in reality.
Yeah.
The community is fairly accepting if you just play by the rules. They'll let you into the club.
Right. No, and I am talking more about the appearance than the actual fact of the matter, certainly.
There's just not quite the level of professionalism in competitive Magic that I would like to see. And I think you could reasonably argue that there's still not enough money in the game to warrant that degree of professionalism, and that can make some sense. That's an argument that's been brought up to me. And there are some people that think that we should be getting the money first, then we'll act professional, and like once the proper incentives are in place, sure, that then we'll stop. I'm sort of the opinion that we are the ones that need to act first.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to be wrong about that, but that's my opinion, and that.
Sure. I mean, Jason, I'm sorry if you want to add something, I can shut up.
Well, I just have one question for Ross. I mean, you mentioned all the positive responses you got from this article in particular. Did you get any overwhelming negative responses from anybody higher up?
I certainly got negative responses, or at least disagreement. None of it was very there wasn't a lot of vitriol. There weren't people who lashed out at me. There were just people that respectfully disagreed, and I had a lot of interesting conversations in the ensuing week. With people that did disagree, we talked about a lot of things, and that was very fruitful discussion. So I did get a healthy amount of disagreement. It was not lost on me that most, if not all, of that disagreement came from other high level players.
Yeah,
make of that what you will.
Right,
but
right.
The overwhelming response, especially from the community at large, was positive. It is not something that they like to see.
Right.
Viewers like to see matches of Magic get played.
Yeah,
exactly. And it's somebody mentioned in the Twitch chat too that they hate even just the splitting just to ensure you get to the top eight, because then nobody gets to see these high level matches towards the end of tournaments, because the guys are just automatically intentionally drawing into the top eight over their last couple of rounds.
Yep.
So it's just worse
with the tournament experience. It doesn't make a huge difference for players in the tournament, obviously, but it makes a huge difference for the viewer. When you're watching the last round of Swiss, you expect to be watching a lot of people who have done really well in the tournament playing for top eight. And most of the time you do get that, because there's usually four or six people that can draw out of the top eight, and then you get two or three matches of people playing that can make top eight.
Yeah.
But not being able to see the people that have really performed that well, you're seeing sort of the next level down. It's certainly bad for viewers.
Right.
So then, Ross, we have this situation. In your opinion, and I'm sure there's a lot of varying ones, as you mentioned, what is, if there is any, what's a good fix? Or what is a good range of fixes?
Yeah.
like this? I mean, have you, and that may be a tough question. There may not be a good answer for that one. I don't know.
Yeah, there is not a great answer. It's one that I've thought a decent amount since the article came out because it was a question that I got from many people. And obviously, what I advocate in the article and I think what the first step is to have a community-driven effort to stamp out collusion as much as we can. But ultimately, like, that's not going to fix the problem. There are always going to be bad actors that act in their best interest. Sure. And we can't, the fact that we can't effectively legislate or regulate away the behavior from the judges, I think means that we have to eliminate the incentive for players to do it. And that requires perhaps a complete redesign of the competitive Magic tournament scene and the way tournaments are structured, the way seasons are structured.
Wow.
It's possible that we've reached a point where the tournaments that we have just aren't the best way of going about things. And I think that you can make an argument that that's true from a number of perspectives. Personally, the experience as a high level player at Grand Prix is fairly poor. It's great for low level players and casual players who are there and treating it more like a Magic convention. It is excellent for those people, and those people should have something like that for them. So the fact that GPs exist in that respect is a very positive thing, and I'd be happy to attend them just for that. But to have them also function as high level tournaments, I think is fairly poor. And we have to start to thinking of ways to design tournaments that create a better viewing experience. And ultimately, I think what that means is reducing the size of tournaments, restricting them to only the top players so that you constantly have these really great future matches going on between two great players. But you leave it just open enough that the bottom has the sort of rotating cast of people that are trying to break in. And so every so often you get that narrative of somebody breaking through to the big time. Because that's what, when players, there are some players and viewers back home that don't like to see just the same 20, 30 people over and over again. And right. those people are numerous enough that we should look to them as well. And you need to have some opportunity for change. But that top crust of players needs to be featured much more often than they are now. And the way Grand Prix work, they just aren't. Because the Grand Prix are too big. There's too much variance in the game. Like, of those 20 people, maybe 10 of them make day two or something, maybe 15, but maybe one of them makes the top eight. And occasionally you get a really stacked Grand Prix top eight, and that's really great. The coverage always goes up. Everybody really likes those. They're super interesting. And so we really need to start thinking about redesigning the way the tournament scene works, the way the entire system works, so that those kinds of things happen more often, and Magic is much more spectator-friendly. And the thing is, like, I know personally a system like that would be horrible for me because I'm not in that crust of player. I am firmly in a tier or two below them, and that I would likely get locked out from those tournaments unless I really stepped up my game, which hopefully I'm able to do. But the fact that that would be better for Magic would ultimately be better for me because then my content would be more valuable and I would still be able to play. There would still be tournaments available for people at my skill level and people below and above my skill level if they wanted to do it. And those tournaments would also become more lucrative as Magic becomes more popular. So even if I was sort of locked out of the highest levels of Magic, it still feels like it's in my best interest to root for something like this, because I think the only way to continue to grow my stake in the game and my visibility within the game is to make the game bigger as a whole. Yeah. It's sort of like I've maximized the size of the slice of the pie that I get in terms of percentage. And so now I just need to make the entire pie bigger. So that's what the article is ultimately working towards. And this is one small part of making the pie bigger.
Yep. And I mean, the potential's out there. You mentioned games like League of Legends. You look at the viewership on their streams and it's just astronomical. So, I mean, you know, it's possible. They just got to figure out the way to make it work.
Well, and I think it's a funny thing because, you know, the way that GPs work, the way that streams work, is a very organic thing, wouldn't you say, Ross? It's something that just kind of developed as the game, particularly the way streams work and viewers and, you know, feature matches. It was this thing that was added on after the fact because everybody liked it, and now it's become a big focal point. GPs, like, when you say you have a poor experience, Ross, would you include the fact that there are 15 rounds or 16 rounds of Magic, you know, over 2 days? I mean, I know from my end doing them wears the hell out of me. It's got to be really rough when a tournament's that big and you need that many rounds to kind of get through everything to get to a top eight.
So I think about that range, 7, 8, maybe 9 rounds.
Sure.
A day is about the cap of what I would want to play. But I think part of the reason that GPs have declined in their player experience for players like me is because they've grown so big, they don't run nearly as quickly as they used to run. So those right. 9 rounds on day one yeah. take a very long time.
It's a good point.
And then you don't get as much sleep for day two, and it sort of compounds the effect. If you were playing these smaller tournaments, one, you might get to play a couple fewer rounds. I bet you would, but it would also just run so much more efficiently that the total time that you would be playing on the day would also be cut by a significant margin, even if you were playing the same 8 or 9 rounds that you were playing before. And so it wouldn't be as much of a drain, and the experience would be better overall. I would love to see a system where, like, Grand Prix had, like, these smaller tournaments were held at a Grand Prix, but it was, like, the main event. And then there might be a bigger open event that would be more akin to what Grand Prix are now at that Grand Prix as well. And maybe that, like, those two tournaments are tied so that, tied together in some way. So if you did well enough at the Grand Prix, you could play at, like, the next main event tournament, system right. like that. And obviously, like, I don't have all the answers. I'm not
sure.
I haven't spent the last 3 weeks developing an entire new tournament system for Magic.
Oh, that was the whole reason we brought you on.
Oh man, all right, forget it.
Yeah, I just don't have that kind of time. But if I were ever lucky enough to be in Watsy's ear and give feedback on things and pitch them ideas, I would love to do that. I would love for them to involve other high level players if they wanted their opinions over mine, which they probably should. But if they wanted to develop a team to maybe look at ways that we can redesign the way Magic works and maybe add another level between Grand Prix and Pro Tours that cater more towards the professional side of the game and creating a good viewership experience, not only for the people at home watching a stream, but maybe the people that are actually attending. You put them in sort of an arena style setting and let people actually sit around and watch. Right now, at Pro Tours, they have a little viewing area set up where you just watch the stream at the Pro Tour venue. And that's nice, and it may actually end up being better, because sometimes it can be difficult to see what's going on if you're watching from above, even if you're standing on like an elevated platform, like what they have set up at Invitationals, if you've been on one of those. But there has to be a way to increase the viewer experience of Magic well past what we have now, because Magic has evolved over the last 20 years, essentially ignoring any possibility of viewers watching it beyond other people in the tournament, like your buddies watching you play the PTQ finals from over your shoulder.
Yeah.
Outside of that, we haven't had to worry about this. So all these systems that we have in place are systems that have developed without the influence of the thinking about these factors. And so if these factors are as important as I'm claiming, and obviously I think they are, then we need to completely rethink how tournament Magic is played.
Okay, cool.
So, I mean, before we kind of leave this topic, Ross, I mean, is there anything else you want to say about it? I mean, I know, as you said, there have been some other guys in the community that have kind of taken up this banner with you. I know Jim Davis has been pretty vocal about this. Brian Bonduin has also been fairly Reed vocal Duke. About this. You know, Reed Duke, yeah. So, I mean, you know, obviously, this didn't just come about in a vacuum, you know. Other people feel the same way you do, and that's a good thing, because you're all pretty smart guys, so I'm sure if anybody can figure out a way to work on this, it's you guys and Watsy, and they seem to listen to the players occasionally, once in a while. but debatable. Is there anything debatable? Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm going to have to figure out what to do with my shops deck now, so that's a problem. But in any event...
But I did 10 years ago in Vintage, did fine. And I have your fancy Lodestone Golem, and I had to walk to tournaments 10 miles in the snow both ways.
Listen, I started playing during Unlimited. What are you talking about? I walked in the snow too.
That might be the case. I was sort of hoping you just get shut down completely.
No. Listen, Sarah Angel is a great card. Let me tell you about Sarah Angel.
Yeah. Why don't we give it flash and make all your creatures indestructible?
Well, all right. So because I do want to get to that before we let you go, and you've been very wonderful with your time, Ross. Is there anything else you want to say on this topic before we kind of switch gears a little bit and before we close this out?
I guess I would just conclude by saying that, as I remarked on before in passing, that this article and my ideas about this have all come around. I've all come about from my desire to see Magic grow as a professional sport. And there are certainly other barriers to that, but I think that this one is important, and the discussion that I've seen around it as a result of the article is more than I could have possibly hoped for. It was sort of a nervous week in the time between my deadline and the article getting posted. I wasn't exactly sure what was going to happen, and I knew I was at least risking a little bit of my own brand, if you want to say that. Ugh, God, that's a horrible thing for me to say.
Did you have that moment as you were about to hit send to submit it to Star City where you kind of like paused and your hand was shaking a little bit and you're like, should I do this?
Yeah, definitely had that moment. Also, like, this was an article that I had read by other people much more than other articles, a lot of prior editing, just to make sure that some of the tone was right and it was conveying exactly what I wanted to convey. I was very careful with a lot of the very specific word choices in it. There are certainly ways that it could have been improved, and talking about overhauling the tournament structure is something that I've come to based on responses from the article and thinking about it after the fact. So I'm happy that I've been able to sort of build upon it, at least in my own thoughts. Hopefully other people have done the same. But I think one of the main criticisms of the article is that I'm being a bit too noble, to the point of being naive in my hope for, expanding Magic as a game to the point where everything sort of trickles down to us as players. And, well, it's certainly possible that I am, sacrificing too much and being too noble, and people who have the same stance as me are doing the same. To me, if I'm going to commit myself to competitive Magic, I can't do that without at least taking a shot at making it as great and as big of a thing as it possibly can be. And so even if it's ultimately a quixotic journey, and I'm tilting at windmills here, I'm more than willing to take up the cause and continue this effort to make Magic as good as I know it can be.
Of course.
I personally applaud you for doing that, because I think it's a good thing that you're trying to do that, and yeah, man.
You don't look like Don Quixote. I mean, you do have probably a pretty nice beard like he did, but I don't think you're tilting at windmills. But speaking of tilting, how's Avacyn worked out for you in testing lately? How's she doing? How's the Sarah Angel with Flash?
Avacyn has been fairly tilting. Mainly because I clearly have no idea how it works. Every time I try to figure out how to play around it, I just get blown away. Somebody passes with 5 mana up against me, like, oh, yes, Avacyn, okay, how should I attack? And I'm sitting there thinking, and one of the guys is over my shoulder watching it, and I'm sort of talking with him, he's not saying anything, and thinking, like, should I attack like this? Maybe if I attack like this, this happens. And I was like, no, I should just, like, I had, like, a Chandra in play. I was like, yeah, I should just, like, plus my Chandra, and then minus my Nissa, so they're 4/2s. So that'll be, like, as big as Avacyn or something, and then I'll make this attack. And it's like, dude, all his things are indestructible. Like, I think he had the Avacyn in play, that was it. And I was like, yeah, I'll just attack into it. And then he just, like, blocked one of them with some other creature, flipped his Avacyn on the next turn, and I was dead on board. And they just looked at me and it's like, Ross, you're an idiot. I don't know what it does. For the first week of testing, I thought it flipped like a werewolf. I was like, that. For some reason, the intricacies of Avacyn escaped me for a while. But once I got the play patterns down, that card is just the nutter butters.
Oh, yeah. Oh, nice.
Shit.
So how has testing been going for Baltimore? And obviously, we don't expect you to hand us all of your trade secrets. But I mean, you know, we've got a lot of players out there who have been proxying up a lot of decks. Jason and I have been proxying up, just a ton of decks. I think I've run our local game store out of basic lands with pen Sharpie markers. So I mean, how has it been going for you? Give us some insight.
Yeah, it's been going really well. We've got a nice group of people down here in Roanoke, obviously, and we've been getting together pretty regularly and testing. I think there were some people over at
that got together today. So I'll talk with them and see if they've learned anything more. We're firing our first draft tomorrow to help people test for the Pro Tour. But the and if you read a lot of the articles from the other Roanoke guys, there's a lot of overlap in all the, in the things that we found out, of course. So if you read the articles, that you'll get a lot of the insight that, that I have. And I think Jerry Thompson's article from today gives a really nice overview of the format and the things that we've found out in our testing. And essentially, we Chandra and Avacyn are probably the two most most powerful cards in the format. And Avacyn is really important at keeping Chandra in check. Just matches up really well against it. They can't effectively minus into five open mana as a four power flyer. It pressures Chandra really well. It can even block one of the three ones if they plump, if they plus at some point. And, so Avacyn, the sort of Avacyn against Chandra war, I think is going to be an important dynamic early on in the format. The mana hasn't been quite as good as I thought it would be. Even splashing into two color decks has been somewhat difficult.
I think
you can, it's difficult, not impossible. You can splash into a two color deck, but you have to be very disciplined in your splashing. You can't go overboard and play anything close to like a full three color deck. It really has to be a tight two colors of the splash. Two color mana bases are generally pretty good. We try to limit the number of enters the battlefield tap lands, but that hasn't been too big of an issue. I think some of the main things that I have found out about the format that I think most people are going to be unprepared and realize in the first 2 weeks of tournaments, unfortunately, is that Arlen Cord and Gideon are not as good as they're overrated right now.
Okay. I have found that out as well.
I was not big on Arlen Cord right from the get-go.
Yeah, the impact of a 2-2, which is like both their default abilities to use in the first turn, from a 4-mana spell is not that high. The 2-2 gets outclassed pretty easily. Avacyn obviously pressures both of them really well. I think Arlen has some potential if you can figure out the play patterns that best use its +1 abilities on either side. I think it was Tom Ross built the red-green deck that we tested, and I played a Naya version of the same deck in a versus video that was played the red Thopter cards, Thopter Engineer, Pian Kieran, along with Nissa, Voice of Zendikar, Arlen Cord, and Chandra. So I had a bunch of Planeswalkers, like, spewed the board with a bunch of creatures, had a lot of ways to pump them between Nissa and the other the flip werewolf side of Arlen. And they had Sylvan Advocate and Hankerback Walker just as nice early cards. And one of the key cards in it was actually Outnumber as a good removal spell. Red is pretty bad in terms of its removal options. Roast is, I would avoid playing at all costs. God. Basically, like, ramp decks play Roast, and it's pretty bad elsewhere. Almost any other card is better. But Outnumber has been the one card that really, really shined. Just, it's pretty easy in that deck with all the Thopters to pay one mana and deal 2, 3, 4 damage even. And once you get up to 4, being able to kill an Avacyn with the trigger in the stack is super important. And having a nice, cheap, flexible removal spell was perfect for that deck. The, rest of the removal goes, like, that's where white really shines. Like, in addition to having Avacyn, white just has the best removal. Stasis Nair is really important. Having instant speed removal to deal with an Avacyn is really important. So Stasis Nair is great. Even though it's not an instant, Declaration of Stone is the Nutter Butters.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that thing's just going to be totally format warping?
I don't think it's. Declaration of Stone. It's certainly going to have an effect on what kinds of threats you play.
Right. Okay. And that's, I guess that's more what I mean, not format warping. That's hyperbolic, but.
It's, I think Hangerback Walker gets a significant downgrade. I basically only want to play it in decks that have ways to sacrifice it itself, so like a Husk deck or Pian Kieran is sort of enough. But I don't think in like the, there's a lot of people playing like green-white Megamorph style decks with Hangerback Walker, and I'm not a big fan of Hangerback in those style decks anymore, even though Command can sometimes kill him. Just not enough impact, too easy to deal with all the exile effects. But Declaration, I don't think something like Secure the Waste, I don't think is nearly as good as people are, touting it to be. There's a lot of decks that play Secure and Gideon. And I have been as impressed with those, but I think they're going to be really popular in the first week, so I'm still sort of preparing for them. And Declaration is just a 2-mana removal spell that deals with way more things than a 2-mana removal spell should deal with.
Yeah. So my big question is, do you think Eldrazi ramp is still going to be viable in some form?
The ramp, So I don't think it's going to be, I don't think it's going to look like the Eldrazi ramp deck that we saw last year because of the loss of Ugin.
Yeah.
Those ramp decks were significantly slower than ramp decks we've seen in the past, mainly because they didn't have access to two mana ramp spells. They couldn't really play Ruin in the Wake.
Yeah.
And as a result, they needed to play only the most high impact spells because they weren't really casting them until turn five or six.
Right.
And Ugin and Ulamog were powerful enough that they let you do that. And Sanctum of Ugin was helpful because sometimes you needed that second threat to really lock up the game. And eventually, like the combo of Kozilek's Return and Worldbreaker sort of gave you a little bit of a smaller ball game that you could play. But I think the ramp deck is going to get a little bit smaller than it was before because Ugin doesn't let you, the lack of Ugin means that you can't just deal with any sort of board state.
Right.
You have to let your seven drops do the talking and have them really take over. But the fact that they have Traverse the Ulvenwald as another way to set up a turn two Ruin in their wake. So you can play that you can play Traverse on turn one or Oath of Chandra or Evolving Wilds and find a Wastes. And then turn two, you get an actual Rampant Growth. Being able to consistently set up a turn two Rampant Growth into turn three Explosive Vegetation or Hedron Archive, and then a seven drop on turn four, either Worldbreaker or Dragonlord Atarka, has been pretty good. We've had some issues just sort of tuning the list, but I think ramp's going to be popular at least in the early weeks. Whether or not it has a lot of staying power, I'm not sure yet. I'm a little low on the deck, to be honest.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if it's not a big player in the standard format, at least until the next set maybe gets another tool. But in certain metagames, it's definitely still going to be good. The metagame ever turns to the point where Worldbreaker and Dragonlord Atarka are difficult to deal with, then I could see it seeing more play. But the fact that you want to be playing all these exile effects anyway just makes Worldbreaker just a lot less good, a lot worse. That's the word I'm thinking of, worse.
Yeah.
I want to escape from it. People being able to so cleanly and cheaply deal with Atarka and Worldbreaker with Stasis Snare and Declaration in Stone is not a good sign for ramp. Like, they couldn't really deal with Anugin with any of those spells. And so they also deal with Ulamog. I guess Ulamog and Worldbreaker both exile potential Stasis Snares, which is kind of nice. I'm more concerned about the front end of that than being able to use my big thing to get back a second big thing.
Right.
After they've killed my first big thing. If you need three big things to win a game as a ramp deck, you usually just don't have powerful enough tools.
Okay. Fair enough. So, and we are going to see you in Baltimore this weekend, right?
Yep.
All right.
I'll be there.
Perfect. Chad or Bob, did either of you guys have any other questions about the new standard before we start closing this out?
We've got a question from the chat for Ross. So do you prefer the Battlelands or the Shadowlands?
I mean, they're very different. I'm not sure exactly the context he's asking the question. You mean in the context of this standard format?
Yeah.
So the way I briefly explained this on a Versus video, I think the one where I played Naya, because the mana base had a mix of them. Mm-hmm. But the way I've approached it is that if you're playing a two-color deck, you're just maxing out on both of them because they're the two best dual lands available other than if you're a friendly colored pair.
Yeah.
So if you're a two-color deck, you're certainly just playing the full eight because they're both good.
Yeah.
But if you are a two-color deck that's splashing, I prefer playing Shadowlands of my main colors because those are the colors I'm probably going to need on the first two turns of the game. And Battlelands obviously never come into play untapped on the first two turns unless you ramped somehow. Because I'm being very disciplined in my splash, usually I'm not splashing early cards. And so I can run a few more of the Battlelands of my splash color. So in the Naya deck, I had four Game Trail because I was base red green, and then two Cinderglade and two Canopy Vista.
Okay.
And I didn't play any of the green white Shadowland because I was expecting to just find my white mana later in the game for my splash cards. And I think that makes sense to me in theory. I haven't played enough with three color decks or two and a half color decks to get a really strong sense of it because the mana has been shaky enough that we really haven't tried a lot of them. And we've been generally happy with a lot of the two color decks we have.
Perfect.
So I guess the last question I would have for you, Ross, is and you don't have to tell me how or who, although I would be interested in who. Tell me somebody in your group has broken Cryptolith, right?
We have built a couple decks with Cryptolith, right?
I wouldn't say we broke it. Michael Majors is usually the resident brewer of the group, so a lot of the brewing comes down to him, although Jerry Thompson does a good bit of brewing as well. Those two, if anyone is going to break it with that card, it's probably going to be one of those two. There's an interesting deck that we built that was similar to the one that got posted on Reddit, but Michael incorporated the infinite combo of Eldrazi Displacer, Brood Monitor, and Zulabor Cutthroat.
Okay. Right.
And you were sort of able to use Cryptolith Rite to help fix your mana in a 2.5 color deck. And Brood Monitor was actively very good in the deck. And blinking it with Eldrazi Displacer bought you a ton of time. And because you were constantly sacrificing things to Evolutionary Leap and Westvale Abbey, Zulabor Cutthroat was actually like an alternate win condition in the deck. And that deck was pretty interesting. I think it's still floating around somewhere. I'm not sure if we'll have time to revisit it. But Cryptolith Rite has been a deck that has been on our minds, but we haven't quite gotten around to. So that's probably something that, and I'm interested in personally. So it's probably something I'm going to work on, in this week. Tuesday and Thursday are like scheduled days, but we might do more than that.
Nice. Cool.
But yeah, have not broken it, with Cryptolith Rite just yet. Maybe with something else.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. Cause I think that card's just sweet. It's got so much untapped potential. All right. Well, Ross, I think we're going to close the show out. I want to just personally thank you. I know. I'm sure Jason and Chad are thankful too. But your article was something No, okay, all right. Jason is not going to thank you, but I am, because I your article was just something that I found really interesting. Got a lot of talk locally and also on the interwebs, for whatever that's worth.
Yeah, happy that there was so much conversation started by it. I think that's that's really important to get everyone's opinions out there, and I was floored by just how big the response was. I knew anytime you write an article on a sort of controversial topic, you get a lot of response about it. It happens every time, but this was still even more than I was expecting, and I was very happy with the tone of all the conversations. Everybody was very respectful of each other. A lot of the conversations were very fruitful as a result. People were able to voice their opinions very clearly, succinctly, and completely, and get very measured and well thought out responses. And so we were able to really have a nice back and forth between varying factions, as opposed to sort of yelling over each other. And I was really happy to actually come on this podcast and talk more about it, because I had I didn't really want to write like a follow-up article, but I definitely had some added thoughts based on those conversations. So having a forum to voice those thoughts in was really helpful. So thank you too.
Great. And where can people find you, Tom, if they want to follow you? Or
did you just call him Tom?
Ross.
Ross.
Not the first time, don't worry.
No. I'm actually looking at a Cryptolith Rite deck, and there's a Tom Ross deck right under it. So that's my mind.
I'll answer your question, but there's a really good story that involves Tom Ross, sort of tangentially.
Go for it.
I was in GP Miami, and this was last March, so well before I moved to Roanoke, but I had been writing for SCG for a while, so I was getting to know some of the SCG guys and the Roanoke guys in particular, and then I think that was the first tournament that I stayed with them. And I was staying in, I don't know what, they rented something, but, we were going to get some food, and that was, it was like me and Brad Nelson, his little brother, Corey Bowmeister, and someone else I can't remember. But we were sort of walking to lunch, and Brad and Corey were ahead of the other two of us. And apparently they were talking, and Brad mentioned to Corey that I was there. And Corey in his head mixed me up with Tom Ross, and apparently Tom and Corey are old buddies. And he just gets really excited, gets this very excited look in his face, and he's like, "Oh, Tom Ross is here!" And we just sort of have to give him the disappointing news that no, we don't mean Tom Ross. And Corey like tried to be diplomatic as he looks at me. He's like, "Oh yeah, that's just as good."
Yeah.
But Ross, if people want to find you, where can they follow you? Where can they, why don't you give your address out if people want to visit you at home? And no, I mean, don't do that. Please don't do that. But where can
Virginia 123 Fake Street.
But
555
555 555. But where can they
Where can they find you on the internet or wherever?
Yeah, so far and away, the best place to get in touch with me is Twitter. I am at Ross M. Boss, an unfortunate Twitter handle that I had.
That's that whole Tom Ross thing coming full circle now.
Yes. So a couple of years ago, when unbeknownst to me, some of my friends from college made a parody Twitter account about me. And that existed for a couple of years without my knowledge. What? And when I started writing, I decided that some of the material on the account was unbecoming and reflected poorly on me and possibly on my new employer, StarCityGames.com. And so I asked them to take that material down, and they hadn't really been active in keeping it up. We decided it was just easier for me to take it over. And I didn't quite know that the handle was at Ross M. Boss, which is not something I would have chosen personally, especially with the overlapping with Tom Ross, because there's no way, there's literal no way that I can be the boss if Tom Ross exists. I'm just not boss, more boss than Tom Ross. He's the boss. That's impossible.
You would need a leather jacket and to become a man of few words.
Yeah, and that's just never going to be me. I am a man of many, many, many words. Far more words than anyone would like to hear me speak. But still, that is my Twitter account. It's not really changing now. I think I can change it. I don't really know. It's not really that big of a deal. But at Ross M. Boss, you can find me there. Message me, tweet at me. I check it very regularly, so I'll get back to you. And the other good way is to, check out my content on Star City Games. Cool. So I do a weekly video that goes up on Fridays versus video with Michael Majors. Those are always fun. I'm on the select side, so you don't need to, pay anything for them. And I do a weekly column. And, oddly enough, that I think this will be the first time I'm telling people, but, my column, which is in the last year and a half, gone up on Thursdays, is starting tomorrow going to go up on Tuesdays.
Oh, nice.
So you can find my this week's article where I talk a bit about Standard, and I wrote about stock decks for this weekend. So basically, a lot of people sort of go too deep in testing for the early tournaments, and they end up dismissing decks because they don't think they're good. And even a lot of the time they're right, the decks aren't good, but that doesn't mean they're not going to get played. And if you can sometimes go too deep and end up with a deck that is good for 2 weeks later, but isn't good for the opening weekend. So I sort of remind people of that, go over some of the decks that I think are going to be popular this weekend in Baltimore. So you can check that out, and then return and check out my articles every Tuesday. And then I do daily digests every other week. So and this week I'm on. So every day this week I just find a sweet deck that did well in a tournament and write a little bit about it. So if you want to find some cool decks to bring to your local store, maybe something for game day, something for FNM, I do the work for you and pour over pages and pages of deck lists for hours on end. I'm basically locked in a room, and Cedric Phillips is whipping me, telling me to find deck lists and write more words. It's pretty horrible.
He seems like a harsh taskmaster.
Yes. I can't say it better. I don't know what I'm going for.
But. No worries. And yeah, Ross, I just want to reiterate what Bob said. Thanks so much for taking the time to come on here and talk with us. It was a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to meeting you in person next time we're both at a big event here in the Northeast. But yeah, other than that, just again, thanks for coming on and talking to us.
Yeah, awesome. It was fun being here. I'll be in Baltimore. I'll also be at GP New York, which unfortunately is in New Jersey.
Hey, easy now.
Not that I'm bashing Jersey, although I frequently do that, but I was just, when it was announced on the schedule, I was excited to have a tournament in New York City. I have friends in the city, so I like seeing them, and I just like New York City, so any excuse I can get to go to the city, hang out, don't have to really drive anywhere, just take the subway everywhere, it's so convenient. Yeah. I love public transit.
Oh yeah, gotcha. It's pretty good up here, that's for sure. So, and with that, Ross, feel free to drop out of the call. We're just going to go ahead and close the show with our final shout outs and everything. But, feel free to drop out now and go about your normal life. But again, just thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, you're welcome. And thanks for having me. This was great.
All right.
Sweet. Thanks. Awesome. Look forward to seeing you. Thank you.
All right. He is out of the call. So let's go ahead and finish with our final thoughts. Bob, do you got anything?
Let's see. Final thoughts. I should make this a good one. I think I'm going to fall flat on my face here, guys. If you play Mud in Vintage, I commiserate with you and feel your pain.
Yes.
That's nice.
No. All right. I think for a final thought, what Tom talked about is important.
Ross, what Ross talked about.
Now I'm doing it as a joke, guys. Okay. Jesus. Can you please get with it?
All right.
Anyway, so I think what Ross talked about is for somebody like me who goes to competitive events, and for anybody who tries to do that, even if you're not going to be a pro, it's still important, because he is really right. If the game grows, everybody benefits.
Yeah.
You know, it you only stand to benefit. And on the outset, that might seem weird because it's more competition and more people, but that's not really the way it works. And I think his explanation is really pretty well thought out about it. So.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, this is going to be a long episode, so for all of you who found this interesting, thank you for bearing with us. For any of you who didn't find this interesting and tuned out early, you aren't even hearing this, so...
So you're just talking fine. To yourself at this point.
Yeah, I'm just talking to myself. Myself. That's right. Chaos theory.
Yes, it's very much so. All right, Chad, I'll let you go next. What do you got?
All right, so just to reiterate, we made this podcast for the same reason that Ross wanted to make the community better, because that is what we're behind. We're all about making the community better. And like Bob was just saying, everybody that listened, everybody that stuck through, that's what we're here to do as well. So just thank you for staying with us. Thank you for listening, following, viewing, everything that you guys have done, joining the Facebook group, Higher Standards. One thing I have to say is tonight I'm going to be working on switching from Twitch, the Twitch channel, to a YouTube gaming. YouTube has started something where they're starting to stream, and I believe it'll benefit the viewers, because for one, every time we record, it's going to be automatically posted to my YouTube channel, and I will start posting that in the Higher Standards room so everybody can follow along. And if you want to view it instead of listen to it, you will have that option every single week. So that's what I've got, and I'm out.
All right. And I've got a few things here, so bear with me. First of all, I want to give a shout-out to my other podcast, Project VCR, as Chad always likes to mock me for. Our Batman episode's been out for a couple of weeks, and this week we are recording Escape from New York, which I have never seen. I'm watching it for the first time tomorrow night.
Wait, what?
I have never seen Escape from New York.
Are you a communist?
Possibly, yes.
I mean, if you grew up in the 80s and you didn't see Escape from New York, that's... And for anybody who is a communist now, that's not the kind of communist I'm talking about. I'm talking about the ones from the 1980s that were scary and going to blow us up.
Right.
Okay? Those are the ones I'm talking about. Jeez,
sorry.
Man.
Sorry, man. All right, so keep an eye out for Project VCR. If you don't listen to it, go listen to it. Subscribe to our channel, because it really helps us out. Big shout out to listener Joseph Elbers. He sent us an email this week, just basically kind of giving us his love, says he's been listening for the last 8 or 9 months, and he also sent us his Red Black Vampires list, which, yeah, I think the Red Black Vampires is legit. That archetype is going to be big in this upcoming standard. I don't know what the best build is. I'm not sure if I'm fond of your 4 lightning axes in the main there, Joseph, but beyond that, I think your deck is a pretty good start. So I would recommend watching the Star City results this weekend and kind of seeing what pops out of that and going from there.
I was just going to say, I just saw the email. I've been a little busy, but I will get back to you with a reply as well and some thoughts. Whether you like them or not, well, you sent the email, so you're going to have to read them.
Yeah.
Okay.
You asked for this, Joe, so... but yeah, and then on a personal note, if you've been following me on Twitter or Facebook or anything, you've been seeing that I've been really committed to the whole health and fitness thing lately. I've been talking about it a little bit here on the show. I post it all the time on Twitter, Facebook. I've been running a lot. I've been watching what I eat. And just tonight, as we mentioned at the beginning of the show, I did my first yoga class.
Go on.
But no, it's something I'm taking really seriously, and it's this new mantra that I kind of have, and it's basically take charge of your life, don't let your life take charge of you. And for the longest time, my life was just kind of taking charge of me. I was just getting up every day, just going about my normal business, just doing what I had to do to get through the day. I was not living a very healthy lifestyle. I was drinking a lot. I was a borderline alcoholic at one point. I was letting my work kind of dictate my mood. It was just a lot of different things going on in my life at once that just kind of put me in a really bad spot. And I've talked about it before here on the show. But again, since January, I've been really getting into the fitness. I've been running a lot. People see I post my runs pretty much every day. I'm watching what I eat. I can't stress enough how important good physical fitness is for the rest of your life. It's for your mental well-being, for how long you are going to live. And it's a problem that we have in the greater magic community. And I've mentioned this before and I've gotten a lot of crap for it, but you can't deny that there's a problem in North America in general, but also in the kind of geek community, I guess, as well, where there's a large percentage of very unhealthy people out there. And I want to try to encourage people and to let you know anybody can do this. Anybody can make this big, massive change in your life. Because when I started, the only thing that I had to buy was the shoes on my feet, the clothes on my back, and the free app for my iPhone to start tracking my runs. So people always make excuses for I can't exercise because of this, or I can't eat well because of this. You can do it. And I'm proof. I'm not rich by any stretch. I kind of scrape by, and I kind of, as far as like financial input, I don't do a whole lot as far as buying workout gear and all that. A lot of it's just running outside, tracking my runs with a free app I have on my phone. I got a Fitbit for Christmas that I just started using today. And the whole point of this is just take charge of your life. Don't let life kind of take charge of you and then just pass you by, because life is short when you really think about it. And you don't want to be one of those people that dies of a heart attack when you're 50 because you sat around all day playing video games or magic or whatever, didn't watch what you ate, and just, you know, didn't take charge of your life. So I challenge everybody to do that. I'm doing that to the best of my extent, and I want to see everybody else be healthy. And I want to see just a better image for our community. And again, I may get some crap for that. I may be fat shaming or whatever, but you know what? I don't give a crap.
There you go.
It's just, you know, this is me and this is what I'm doing, and I just encourage everybody else to do the same. So
no, there's nothing wrong with being healthy, Jason, regardless of what shape that takes, as long as it's healthy.
Right. Yeah. And you know, you could, it's not about physical appearance. It's not about how you look. It's about how healthy you are on the inside. It's a lot. They do correlate a lot of the time. I mean, one goes hand in hand with the other a good portion of the time, but no pun intended. But yeah, it's really just about having a healthy lifestyle. And again, I encourage anybody to just kind of take a step back and kind of look at yourself and ask yourself, is life passing me by? Is my life taking charge of me? So just think about that and, ponder for a week until next time.
You've certainly given us a lot to think about.
I have. So, you guys got anything else before we, do our usual closeout?
I'm good for now.
All right.
Nope. I'm good.
All right. Next week, first tournament reports from the new standard.
Yes.
Be there, be square. It's going to be very exciting. I'm really looking forward to it. And with that, we will be back.